Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, in light of that children's story, I'll skip my fishing story. Not that it was, you know. I've been spending time reading about the Reformation and Lutheranism and Calvinism and Unitarianism and the shift away, breaking off from the Catholic Church during the Reformation, and just have really come to realize, and sometimes I think, I know I take it for granted, that when we read our seven principles, and they have their own story and their own history, and some people say it was the best we could do to combine Unitarians and Universalists. And some people have a high view of them and a low view of them, which is the way history works. But I want to communicate how unique us reading those seven principles are and how special they are. Because here it is, a religious group of people that reads a set of principles as opposed to a creed, as opposed to a set of beliefs that we all have to believe in, reads a set of principles that perpetually points beyond themselves. And in reading during the Reformation, and I know that I was talking to somebody recently, and they said, well, during the Reformation, there was a liberation in Luther and Calvin moving away from the Catholic Church. And actually, that's not true. And I've talked before about first order and second order change. I don't know if you remember that. And first order change is something like this. Say I'm struggling with an addiction, and the first order change would be I give up my primary or my favorite or the addiction that I say that I like the best, but then I turn around and I become compulsive about religion. I really haven't changed compulsive behavior. I've just changed the expression of that compulsive behavior. So it's a change, but it's first order change. Second order change is when, say, that I have this struggle with this addiction, and I find out what's going on inside of me, and I find out the emotional triggers that move me to a compulsive behavior, and I get into a path of recovery that calms those emotional and calms those compulsive behaviors, those emotional behaviors down, actually get in touch with the history that provoked them and work on that history and soothe that anxiety and heal that woundedness, and I'm no longer addicted, but I'm also no longer compulsive. Second order change. During the Reformation, when Luther broke away from the Catholic Church and when Calvin created his Reformation stance, they created a set of beliefs. They created a creed that you also had to be obedient to, the same as the Catholic Church. It was a different language with some different twists, but if you did not believe that creed, you were punished by death. You were punished by prison. It had the same consequences. So the Reformation from the Catholic Church and reforming the religious expression, the Calvinists and the Lutherans, that was first order change. That was shifting from one addiction to another addiction. That was shifting from a creeds and a set of beliefs that if you didn't believe in those creeds and set of beliefs, you were punished severely to the point of death, to a different language structure, but the outcome was the same. You were punished by death. But with the Unitarians, that simply was not so. If you read the thing, and if you got the Gallimaufry and read in the Gallimaufry, you said one of the founders of the Unitarian movement, David Francis, he said he had the experience at first starting out as a Lutheran, close to the Catholic Church. Then he moved to Calvinism and understanding Calvinism. Then he moved to Unitarianism, and then he moved added something to Unitarianism that was beyond what existed, and as he learned, he continued to move beyond his belief systems and eventually was killed for it. So when we make second-order changes, there's going to be consequences, but yet at the same time, in reference to the sermon today, what are the characteristics of sacredness? If we're going to talk about sacred, then we have to talk about sacred in terms of first order change and second order change. And what I'm saying today is that if it's truly sacred, it moves from the experience of first order change to second order change. There's a true transformation. There's an experiential shift. It's not a shift of language. It's not a shift of behavior. It's not just a shift of context. There's a true change within ourselves. And as I understand history, that is unique with Unitarian Universalists. That is what makes us different as a religious group. I wanted to, in the last sermon, we talked about four paths of inner transformation, if you remember. And those four paths were the cultivating of the ethic of the other, radical obedience, the intentionality and relationship to the space in between one another, and then letting go of our inner blocks. But several people had asked me, you said we covered four, but they said, but you only talked about three. And that was true. I did only talk about three. So I thought I'd briefly mention that fourth. But also, I was wondering if any of you, if you remember when we talked about the space in between one another, the space between ourselves and nature, the space between ourselves in a world, how important that is to developing this ethic of the other. Being aware that there is another person here, that this other person has dreams, this other person has their own story, this other person has their own emotional life, this other person has their own hopes, their own perspective, their own view. And true dialogue means as I engage that person, I consider that. In terms of pastoral care, another example would be is that, say that there was a time in my life when I went through a divorce and I was in Louisville, Kentucky, and my ex-wife and son moved to Baltimore, Maryland. And on the first Father's Day, somebody would come up to me and say, "Happy Father's Day." Well, for me, that wasn't a happy Father's Day. So in that principle of the ethic of the other, if somebody knows my story, and that is part of the ethic of the other, to know the other person's story, if they would have known my story, they would not have come up to me and said, "Happy Father's Day." They would have come up to me and said, "Well, how are you doing? What's going on with you? You know, are you okay? Do you need to go somewhere? You know, I'm a bit," or whatever pastoral care might be appropriate. So that ethic of the other and honoring that space in between, recognizing the other story, the person's story is in between me and then my story too. I was wondering if anybody practiced that this week and stopping, and remember I suggested that you stop and look at a tree or look at another person or look at a pond or look at something and just become aware that there is a space between you and that outside thing. If you stop and ponder, what is it that you project in the middle, or what was your experience in doing that? Now, I'm not going to ask you to bow your heads and raise your hand to... But I continue to encourage you that there is something unique when we move through the world and we stop and breathe and we recognize that there is an otherness out there, other than myself, and that I can stop and try to work with that. And I talked a little bit about last week, projecting my ideas between self and the other, and then actually my ideas determining how I'm experiencing and interpreting that. So that would be the ethic of the other. But the one I did not talk about was letting go of the true inner blocks of self-expression. And just briefly, what I'd like to say about that is, my guess is everybody in here knows what's going on in your life that gets in the way of the best expression of yourself. My guess is we've wrestled with those demons and those voices for years and years and years. And my encouragement for us, for myself and for others at this point, is take that whatever it is that has gotten in your way from you being your best self, from hindering your self-expression. Because when we talk about really redefine sacred in a way, and I'm going to talk about that, that self-expression is what is sacred. And if I've got something inside of me that blocks that, then I want to shift away from that. Many of us may have given up. Said I'm not going to wrestle with that anymore. I'm done with that. I've got to live in spite of that. That's who I am. That's how I am. And I'm going to encourage you to revisit that decision if you have made it. And let's make this year the year to revisit that and recognize those four principles of inner transformation and kind of make those the heart of our spiritual work. The sermon today, and I realize that in using the word sacred, the characteristics of what is sacred, that somebody, if you would remember that when the Unitarian Universalist Association was wrestling with language of reverence, that I had some words to say about that. And if you just change language of reverence, you really don't change the meaning. You just change the language. You don't necessarily change the experience of the person. You just change the language and made that distinction. And then I thought, well, here I am preaching about the language of reverence in a way. So am I contradicting myself? And I don't think so. I don't think I'm contradicting myself. I'm sure I'm not. Because with this sense of being sacred that I am talking about, it isn't about the sacredness of something other than who we are. It's about something of the evolution of our own personal experience. And to begin this sermon, I begin, we Unitarian Universalists come to church for something. Something that feeds our souls, something that heals us, comforts our sorrow, provokes our intellect, encourages our struggle for social justice, to see friends, to affirm a sense of belonging and community, and for other reasons. We search for meaning beyond ourselves that we can aspire to, a cause bigger than ourselves that we can participate in and belong to. We search for justice. We search for honor, for something that we can call sacred, that is human, and that is good. Yet we Unitarian Universalists have a difficult time with this language of reverence. And there are some churches I might not even begin to use that language, the terms of language of reverence and what is sacred. Because that language reaches into our faith ancestors' history. This language of reverence, this language of sacred, reaches back into our faith ancestors' history, and we remember the persecution of those who said, in the name of God, and those who said, this is a sacred act that harmed Unitarians and Universalists in time. We remember that part of our history. But yet, if we reject that language, we may risk losing something that is genuinely whole, holy and sacred, that is good about what it means to be human, that which causes us to respond to a greater good, to protect and recognize that which is good. Other religious groups call something sacred that is a belief system, a belief structure. That they have even gone so far as to create stories that they would call sacred stories that have the destruction of humankind at the end of the story. And yet that is sacred, it just kind of drives me crazy in some ways when I read it. And even in the New Testament, some of these groups that create these sacred stories that puts us on a suicidal path and kind of encourages us on that suicidal path, so we have suicidal intervention by the God that they understand, and then they would go off to heaven. Yet at the same time, in the sacred book that they use, there's this understanding and passage that is very clear. It says that the created, which is humankind at that point, they're talking about the created, worships that which they create and calls that idolatry.
these belief systems and these sacred stories are created by human beings. Human beings created these stories, and they ad lib on these stories, and they make larger, smaller, depending on what era of time you're in, with different nuances. And when they do that, they actually worship the story that they created. When you say that the story that you created is sacred, that story gets locked in place. And the best you can do with that is draw absolute truth from that and lock it in, and that's it. This is the sacred story, and it's more sacred than your story. It's more important than your story because it's our sacred story. And to get back to our principles, if you follow the seven principles that we read and that we claim as Unitarian Universalists, it does not allow that. It does not allow absolutizing a story and calling it sacred. By the very nature of who we are as a people, we counter that and have paid a price for that through history. Another example to go along with that. I don't believe that humankind is destined to be on a suicidal path. I don't believe that. But yet, I could argue that. I could argue that the evolution of who we are as beings, that our symbol-making process, that we can take things and make symbols for them that led us to our technology, to our weapon development, and to our economic systems development. And I can say, well, clearly, if you pollute the water you drink and you pollute the air that you breathe and you make some people special and diminish the quality of life and kill other people so that others can live better, I can back out and look at those patterns and think and look at us beings that we are suicidal beings. We are on a path to destruction because indeed we are destructive as beings. So, and yet, at the same time, there's another voice that comes from what it means to be human. There's another group of people that looks at this destructive path and says no. And I'm saying that other voice has its roots and has its origin in what I'm going to call sacredness, in the sacred. And we can see that we human beings, it gets confusing because we human beings have this capacity to call a story sacred, to draw our values from a sacred story and create a system of life that's actually harmful to what it means to be human. We do have that capacity. And we see it. We see that capacity. So we ask ourselves, how is it that what it means to be human, what it means to be kind, what it means to reach out in generosity, what it means to be hopeful, what it means to be helpful, what it means to be cooperative, what it means to have a religious sensibility that says, all are welcomed here. You can have whatever beliefs you want. Our primary concern is how we treat one another, and we're going to move in the direction of treating one another with kindness, regardless of your beliefs. We wonder how that way of life has been disempowered. We wonder how that way of life and the impulse to that way of life has been so numbed out that we in this country aren't outraged when we see other than that. How is it that we aren't outraged? How is it we have numbed that out that I'm going to call sacred? How do we begin to have a recognition of what is sacred and move to the definition of sacred to be experiential as opposed to propositional, as opposed to beliefs? Because if I can anchor my experience in what I would call sacred and honor that experience, I'll have keen radar to what would numb that out. And I'm going to suggest that the central model or the central human experience of what is sacred is when the mother or a primary caretaker is feeding the infant. That we must anchor what is sacred in the human experience. We must anchor that. Otherwise, we will create belief systems that are sacred that are actually harmful to human beings. If we don't anchor what is sacred in the human experience. So if we anchor our understanding and put the root of our understanding of sacred in this act of feeding the infant, we begin to see something that's crucial in this way of understanding sacred. The first thing is, sacred is relational. You have an infant. And you have the infant having its needs met, having its physical needs, psychological needs met. The spirit of the infant is resting in the body of the infant. The spirit of the mother is resting in the body of the mother. And why that particular point is so valuable to understand is that when we are anxious, our spirit's out here. Our spirit's raging, or our spirit's angry, or our spirit's anxious, or something. But when we are at ease, and our spirit is resting in our body, and we are calm, we do no harm. And we are around others who are similar, they do no harm. We are now in a safe environment. And I'm going to say that is a sacred human experience. Something else occurs in that sacred spot. The primary caregiver, the mother who's feeding the infant, is their eyes are 8 inches to 12 inches from each other, and that has meaning for that infant because they can lock into place and they make a connection, and there's a fusion and there's a oneness there, and there's a sense of wonder there, and they get lost in one another. And that goes as well for men as for women. I can remember feeding my son, and you do get lost in that place. But something else happens. As the adult begins to engage that infant in baby talk, whatever, however, it starts stimulating the brain of that child, and the neurons start moving, and language structure starts happening, and there's potentializing of what it means to be infant is there, and then what it means to be human begins to unfold without any real thought or intent. It just happens. It's what it means to be human. It just begins to unfold. It just begins to happen. A psychologist, D.W. Winnicott, puts it this way. When a mother takes care of a child, a fusion between mother and child occurs. Eventually, this state of oneness begins to open up, and the infant looks around the environment and starts to take in other images. This begins the creation of the potential space, or the space between the infant and others, between the mother and infant. And it will not occur, and this it will not occur unless that sense of oneness is opened up gradually with care. You can see this in the 2 or 3 year old. If you watch a parent or you watch it and experienced it yourself, you watch a child begin to walk away from you, and you'll just stand there, and because in your head you're wondering how far they're going to get, right? Because they're wandering away, and they're standing wandering away, and then they turn around and check to see if you're still there. And then they go a little further and check to see if you're still there. And then all of a sudden, they turn around and they run back to you because they get a little anxious because there's a little too far away. That's the gradual opening up, the gradual play, the unfolding of what it means to be developing as a human being.
For the lucky infant, he says, for the lucky infant, the world starts behaving in such a way that it joins up with her imagination, so that the world is woven into the texture of the imagination, and the inner life of the baby is enriched with what is perceived in the external world.
That is sacred. That is what it means to be sacred as a human being. That we're in a community, that we begin to potentialize ourselves, and that potentialization is affirmed. I was talking to one person. They say, "Yeah, but you're just talking psychology, and we want theology, you know." And then, yeah, I said, wait a minute. All theology and all psychology, almost all, is an attempt to understand who we are as human beings. These are all attempts to understand what we're doing here, how we can get along better with one another, how we're going to make meaning together, how we're going to exist together. No matter whether you call it psychology, theology, sociology, these are all attempts to understand what it means to be human. So to categorize is almost like creating a belief system that's sacred, that you absolutize, that can't span into dialogue with other belief systems. So I think we have to be careful with that. I think what this psychoanalytical theorist is talking about is sacred. The question for us as a church, if that is true, how do we translate that into our behavior with one another? How, when somebody walks in that door, do we become, in essence, as this person talks about, the holding environment where human potentialization can occur, is what he's talking about. That there's a container, there's a holding environment that no matter where you are, that holding environment soothes your anxiety, calms you down so that your truest self can find expression. So if you do choose to struggle with that thing that you know has blocked you, that when you come into this door, whatever that is and whatever emotions that support that thing that has blocked you from your best expression, that in this place, somehow we're going to arrange ourselves so that it's okay to talk about her, it's okay to be with her, it's okay to let that go while you're here. That this is a safe enough place for all of who you are, for all of your story told somehow. That this place becomes a safe enough place so that we can become what it means to be human. When we look at the Unitarian Universalist roots back to the Reformation, we see this. This isn't foreign stuff. This isn't foreign ideas. These aren't foreign ideas. These are throughout our history. When you read the beginning during the Reformation, or you read the Transcendentalists, or you look at the suffrage movement, this is what this is about. So when we talk about sacred as Unitarian Universalists, if we allow ourselves to do that and move into that community to talk about that language, we are talking about the human experience. We're not talking about something other than human. We hope to intervene in the mess that we've created that's never going to come, so that we're always in the mess that we're created. We can look at 2,000 years of that, right? But we're talking about the human experience, that we engage the mess we've created to bring order to it. And we can do that in this church and the community that we live in, the here and now, not some other time, or not bring some past model of life and impose it upon us and be obedient to it. The sacred is the here and now. It's not about the past. It's about the evolution, human experience, now.